individuals unwilling or unable to adapt from stages 2 and 3. The next chapter is your navigation guide to this book. Most corporate tribes are mostly at stage 3 or below. Where's yours? The next chapter will help you find out, give you a few rules of the tribal road, and then direct you to the chapter that will give you the tools to nudge your group to the next level. Key points from this chapter. What makes some tribes more effective than others is culture. Each time people speak, their words exhibit the characteristics of one of 5 tribal stages. Stage 5 outperforms 4, which accomplishes more than 3, which gets more done than 2, which is more effective than 1. A medium to large tribe, 50 to 150 people, usually has several cultural stages operating at the same time. Tribal leadership focuses on language and behavior within a culture. This book does not address cognitions, beliefs, attitudes, or other factors we cannot directly observe. Chapter 3. The Tribal Leadership Navigation System. About 3/4 of workplace tribes have a cultural stage 3 or below. The goal of this book is for you to upgrade your tribes to stage 4. This chapter is your navigation system, showing you which chapter to jump to find the leverage points to nudge it forward faster, and how to emerge as a tribal leader. Tribal Locator System. The key in locating your tribes is to listen for how most people talk, to notice how most people structure their work relationships. You'll see elements of many cultural stages in your tribes, so look for what is most common. Signs of Stage 1. Most people talk as though they are alienated from organizational concerns. When they cluster together, they form isolated gangs that operate by their own rules, often based on absolute loyalty to the group. Many people are socially alienated, never talking to anyone. The theme of their words is that life has given them a bad deal. So, it's okay to do whatever it takes to survive. There may be acts of violence, such as fistfights or extreme verbal abuse. Minor acts of theft or vandalism are a problem. If this description represents your work groups, they are stuck in stage 1. Go to chapter 4 and listen through to the end of the book. Signs of Stage 2. People talk as though they are disconnected from organizational concerns, seeming to not care about what's going on. They do the minimum to get by, showing almost no initiative or passion. They cluster together in groups that encourage passive-aggressive behavior, talking about how to get out of work or how to shine the boss on, while telling people in charge that they are on board with organizational initiatives. The theme of their communication is that no amount of trying or effort will change their circumstances, and giving up is the only enlightened thing to do. From a managerial perspective, nothing seems to work. Team building, training, even selective terminations appear to do nothing to change the prevailing mood. The culture is an endless well of unmet needs, gripes, disappointments, and repressed anger. Go to chapter 5 and continue listening to the end of the book. Signs of Stage 3. People engage in anything that's going on with energy and commitment. But when you listen closely, they talk mostly about themselves and focus on appearing smarter and better than others. They think they're focused on team concerns, but their actions show their interest is personal. People tend to form 2-person relationships, So if they manage a group of 10, they have 10 relationships. They rarely bring people together. They resist sharing information, except when it's necessary, and they pride themselves on being better informed than others. Winning is all that matters, and winning is personal. People at this stage complain that they don't have enough time or support, and that the people around them aren't as competent or as committed as they are. Stage 3 has a symbiotic relationship with Stage 2, so it's important to start there. Go to Chapter 5 and continue listening to the end of the book. Signs of Stage 4. Teams are the norm, focused around shared values and a common purpose. Information moves freely throughout the group. People's relationships are built on shared values. They tend to ask, what's the next right thing to do? And to build ad hoc partnerships to accomplish what's important at the moment. Their language focuses on we, not me. If two people get in a squabble, a third will step in and repair the relationship rather than create a personal following for himself. Unlike Stage 2, the group is composed of people who have played the Stage 3 game and won, and are ready for genuine partnerships. Your first job is to make sure each person is stable at Stage 4. As most groups at this level crash down to Stage 3 when under stress. Go to Chapter 7 and listen to the end of the book. Signs of Stage 5. Your tribes hardly ever refer to the competition except to note how remarkable their own culture is by comparison, and how far their results outstrip industry norms. The theme of communication is limitless potential, bounded only by imagination and group commitment. People in this culture can find a way to work with almost anyone, provided their commitment to values is at the same intensity as their own. Unlike Stage 4, the focus isn't on our values, but on resonant values. There is almost no fear, stress, or workplace conflict. People talk as though the world is watching them, which may well be the case, as their results are making history. Your job is to make sure the infrastructure to maintain these leaps to Stage 5 is in place. Go to Chapter 9 and listen to the end of the book. How to Become a Tribal Leader. The people who use the stage-specific leverage points to upgrade the tribal culture emerge as tribal leaders. Such individuals, we found in our research, do a lot of work on themselves as they make changes in the tribe. This tribal leader prep work includes learning the language and customs of all 5 cultural stages. Look at the next 6 chapters as a travel guide for all 5 lands. Listening for which tribal members speak which language. In essence, who is at what stage? Moving yourself forward so that your own center of gravity is at least Stage 4. You can do this only by talking a different language and shifting the structure of relationships around you. Chapter 7 is the most important in the book. If you let it, it will nudge you into seeing the value of Stage 4 and the hollowness of Stage 3. We suggest you spend some time thinking about the content of that chapter and discussing it with important people in your life. Remember that tribal leadership is not about changing ideas or gaining knowledge. It is about changing language and relationships. It's not about intellectualizations. It's about action. Build a support network around you so that you are stable at Stage 4. Chapters 9 and 10 are the keys here. Take these actions as you upgrade the tribe around you. Remember that as a person builds the tribe to stage 4, she is recognized as the tribal leader, which gives her the ability to bring the group to higher levels of success. Once you have completed the prep work on yourself and have gotten a core group of people in your tribe to stage 4, there are shortcuts that stabilize them very quickly so that they don't fall back to stage 3. Chapters 9 through 11 explain these techniques. Pay special attention to triads, values, developing a noble cause, and building a tribal strategy. Leaders can upgrade most tribes one full level within 90 days, boosting everything from revenue to employee satisfaction. You will find many free tools and resources on our website, triballeadership.net. In the next 5 chapters, we will go through each stage and show exactly how tribal leaders advance individuals within the tribe to the next level of effectiveness. We now turn to the language and customs of each culture, and the next chapter takes us to stage 1. Key points from this chapter. Each cultural stage has its own way of speaking, types of behavior, and structures of relationships. Tribal leaders do 2 things. 1. Listen for which cultures exist in their tribes, and 2. Upgrade those tribes using specific leverage points. The chapters that follow detail each cultural stage and present the leverage points to move to the next stage. Part 2. Your journey as a leader. Leading others through the stages. Chapter 4. Stage 1. On the verge of a meltdown. Frank Jordan's childhood was spent on the brink. His mother died in 1945, when he was 10 years old. In a time before foster homes, he was sent to live with a series of relatives and then with families of friends he made in school. He lived in 8 different San Francisco neighborhoods in 5 years, until he was 15. "I had a lot of time on my hands, and that's dangerous," he told us. "But when I turned about 12, I ran into a boys and girls club, and if it hadn't been for that, who knows where I would have ended up." As it turns out, Jordan ended up in some amazing places, as chief of police and then mayor of San Francisco. Now at age 71, he is a tribal leader in the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation. Moore was the founder of Intel, which invests in projects that will benefit future generations. Many parts of Jordan's story are exceptional, and we'll get to know him more in later chapters. Perhaps the feature that stands out the most is that he never gives up on anyone, especially on the people many of us pretend don't exist, those at stage 1. Although stage 1 accounts for fewer than 2% of American professionals, employed people in our studies, the percentage of those people in society is much larger. If you ask people in it what they think about life, as we did, you'll hear, "It's not fair. I can't cut a break," and, "You do what you have to do to survive." In this chapter, we'll look into stage 1, what it looks like from the inside, how it works, and what you can do to nudge people out of it. Stage 1. Each stage has a beginning, a middle, and an end. At the earliest point of stage 1, we find a cluster of people who all buy into the same view, that life sucks, and they act accordingly. For many readers of this book, early stage 1 is as foreign as life on Mars. But It is a reality for millions of Americans, many of whom end up employed at some point. Companies need to know what to do about stage one, and our society has to address it. As a former police officer, Jordan sometimes receives cold welcomes at San Francisco community events. "You're the problem," people sometimes tell him. "Why?" is his question. As though Jordan were the entire police force, he hears, "You arrested my brother," and "You broke down my door." "You have to see it from their side," he told us. "There's a resentment because they feel life is upside down and they don't know who else to take it out on, so you listen, and listen, and listen." Once he hears all the reasons why people distrust police, he'll say, "I have been there. I don't know how difficult your situation is, but I've had some difficult situations too." As he describes his life to community groups and to children one-on-one, he tells about many of his childhood friends who ended up in violence in prison. He told us, "Some of my friends were stealing cars and money out of their mother's and father's wallets. Some started to shoplift. It starts so easily. We'd find someone coming out of a side door at a theater and we'd slip in and see movies for free. If you continue down that road, it's how you end up in the wrong crowd." We would change the end of his sentence to a stage one tribe. If I talk to a group of 45 people, I might reach 5, he says, a note of desperation in his voice. And then another 5. But what else can you do? When he's successful, he often gets them involved in the Boys and Girls Clubs, where, as he says, they have mentors and teachers for everything. Jordan is right. The best way to jump out of early stage one, the zone of prisons and gangs, is to become involved in tribes with a later dominant stage. In another city thousands of miles away, Tom Mahoney, Cherise Valenti, and Brian Sexton have the job of keeping the rest of us safe from early stage one. They are prosecutors in the gang unit of the Illinois State Attorney's Office in Chicago. Tom dresses like a banker and always has a joke at the ready. Cherise looks like Mariska Hargitay, who plays a female detective on Law & Order Special Victims Unit, complete with jeans and a large belt buckle. Brian, a tall, aging athlete with the boyish air of a choir boy, is the supervisor of the group. Tom and Cherise are deputy supervisors, and their group totals 17 prosecutors. The usual pattern is that a kid is born into a family with a gang history. The uncle, father, even grandfather is a gang member. There's nothing to do in the neighborhood, and because the kid often lacks a father figure, the gang becomes a surrogate family. They get busted for property crimes and spend some time in juvenile hall. When they get out, they have earned rank in the gangs. Brian notes, at some point, the value system gets all screwed up. They can make minimum wage at McDonald's or $1,000 a day doing drug sales. The prosecutors know stage one well. According to Tom and Cherise, stage one is not based on lack of intelligence, as many people outside it may think. In fact, while most gang members lack education, some are brilliant, such as one gang that developed an elaborate strategy to commit mortgage fraud. Some of their members pirated a Christian radio station, played uncut obscene rap music, and inserted code words to warn their members if the police were coming or send word out that there would be a shooting later in the day. Every once in a while, the gang would try to intimidate a witness, as in one case when 60 people showed up at the court wearing white t-shirts and jeans instead of gang colors. They were trying to scare witnesses and the jury, many of whom lived in the same neighborhood. The three prosecutors are passionate about their work, yet when they talk about the lifestyle of the many people in gangs, their faces change to looks of concern, empathy, and sadness. These kids are usually neglected or abused, Cherise said, and they really don't feel they have a choice. The cost of this lifestyle is prison or death, Brian said, his two deputies agreeing. It's tragic. Exploring Stage 1. We ask people in Stage 1 to tell us about life, and we listened to what words they associated with it. We heard not fair, shit, pointless, and fucked up. The most common word we heard was sucks. People at Stage 1 don't believe life sucks because for them, it does suck. They think they are reporting the way it is. In fact, their view of life is a direct consequence of the language they use. Early in our research, we were doing a consulting project for a youth center that helps to get kids out of gangs. Dave sat with someone new, fresh off the streets, as the staff described him. As often happens when people with different language systems sit down, they couldn't communicate at all. Dave tried to give him a pep talk, and the boy shifted his weight, leaned on an elbow, and said, "Man, you just don't get it at all." He was right. In fact, neither of them got it. It was like shining a red light into a green filter. No matter how much a person says it's really red, it still looks green to the person on the other side of the lens. No matter how much Dave said life doesn't suck, for that young man, it did suck. And from his perspective, Dave was just stupid for not seeing it. Stage 1. A View from the Inside. So, what is it like to live inside Stage 1? From our research, it goes something like this. Life sucks. So there's no point to values, vision, or morality. In fact, these seem like con games designed to make us miss the obvious truth of life, which is that it isn't fair. It's a vile place, and we all die. Sure, life would be better if everyone followed the game, but at its core, life sucks, so it's both better and easier to give in to the reality of the situation. As the prosecutors told us, people at Stage 1 don't feel that they've chosen this way of living. Rather, they have recognized life as it really is. Coaching tip. Emphasize choice. Frank Jordan told us, "I tell people they have a choice, and at first, they don't believe me. But I say, I'm like you. I grew up with one parent, and not much to do, and I chose a life of service. And so can you." There are two aspects of his pitch that are noteworthy. First, he doesn't look down on people, no matter their cultural stage, and as a result, he slowly builds rapport. Second, he emphasizes the one thing that Stage 1 doesn't see: choice. As he told us, if people can see that they have a choice, they sometimes choose a better life than gangs and drugs. Stage 1 is a place where people feel that they are cut off from others. It's as though life is happening over there, and they aren't invited. At its deepest level, it takes the attitude that the only really enlightened people are the ones over here who know that what's going on over there is a sham. So it's actually better to be over here, away from the hypocrisy. After all, life is going to end badly, so what's the point of pretending otherwise? This is the viewpoint people express through their words. All of this leads to a mood of despairing hostility. People give in to their desires, they act against their values, and everything is permissible: violence, suicide, drugs, any kind of sex. If indulged long enough, these appetites turn into addictions, reinforcing the person's view That life sucks. One of the addictions people surrender to is that they're special. Many of the people we interviewed in doing our research said, with anger in their voices, that their teachers didn't recognize their gifts, so they left school. Their friends don't see their uniqueness, so they aren't really friends. Stage one is where people embrace this feeling of being different, to the point where their functional tribes, with a dominant stage two and beyond, disown them. They are alienated, adrift, but also free to act on any impulse. As we've seen in our empirical research, stage one can only lead to one of three places: a stage one tribe, for example a gang, death, or stage two. Prisons, we learned in our research, are mostly stage one cultures. There are obvious exceptions. Nelson Mandela was clearly at stage four, if not five, when he was in prison in South Africa, spending his time teaching fellow inmates to read, raising his fellow prisoners to at least stage two. Sadly, most people at early stage one leave it only by dying. Stage one is also the wellspring from which terrorist cells arise. Early stage one. Early stage one is a place where people's tribes are exclusively stage one. They arrive at stage one in two different ways. First, they descend into this stage and their tribe, made up of people at later stages, disowns them. They are lost, alienated, and alone, and a stage one tribe adopts them. Since, for all of us, our tribe tells us who we are, the stage one tribe grinds into them that life sucks. As the prosecutors told us, one of the few rules of gangs is loyalty, so they find they can't leave even if they wanted to. The second way they enter early stage one is that they feel their tribe doesn't really get them. It doesn't see how special they are. Another tribe, at stage one, does see their talents, and they switch. Early stage one calls our prison system into question. People enter prison at all stages, but most dominant prison cultures are at stage one. As people do their time, their new tribe tells them how life works and who they are. In many cases, they leave prison, now disowned by the people who used to be in their tribe, including their families, and they drift to dominant stage one tribes. Our prison system drives people to the bottom of stage one. This situation becomes a problem for the organizations that employ them. Middle stage one. People at the middle of the stage usually descend from stage two in an addictive binge. As they give in to their appetites, their tribe disowns them, at least for a time, and they are lost. Those who wander for long without a tribe often end up in early stage one. One man we got to know in our research is an artist named Joseph. He describes his work and his method of creation in this way. There's a technique I do that people call painting, but professionals call it sculpting. Mind-altering substances are involved. A lot of controlling of the mind is involved. He takes cocaine for several days, then shuts the world away for a 48-hour stretch of making art. When he emerges from this drug high, and from the crash, he finds that his wife, daughter, and mother have kicked him out for a month in what they call the 30-day penalty. He crawls his way out of stage one to two, where, as we'll hear in the next chapter, his life sucks, as opposed to life sucks. We interviewed a member of Joseph's tribe, William, a designer and general contractor in Chicago, who often employs him as a subcontractor when he's sober. He describes his reaction to Joseph this way. "It's like the movie The Horse Whisperer. If one of the younger horses misbehaves, the head horse will push it away, but not totally out of sight. After a while, she'll let the horse back in and try again. Hate the sin, love the sinner. That's what I do." As they are pushed out, the offender falls to the middle of stage one. Another member of the William Joseph tribe is Rick, who has 18 misdemeanors for theft. His friends describe him as a kleptomaniac. When he gets caught, he descends to the middle of stage one, cut off, unemployed, and alienated. While the person at the middle of stage one feels alienated, the truth is often that others are waiting, watching, and hoping they recover. When they do, tribes with a dominant stage two or higher welcome them back, but also put them on probation. Some remain in the middle of stage one for months. In fact, many famous artists and writers have done astonishing work in this zone, but most either descend to early stage one, or in the case of drug use, die. Coaching tip: set the boundaries, but never give up. William's advice is consistent with our research. A surprising number of managers we interviewed had dealt with employees who abused drugs, who were alcoholic, and who even committed rape and murder. While your response to such behavior should be governed by your human resources department, we found that many managers never gave up on employees, even when they were terminated. Many would phone, go see the ex-employee, and keep in touch, sometimes visiting them in prison. Many ex-employees who were treated this way eventually returned to the working world, often in the same company, crawling their way out of stage one and inspiring many others along the way. Late stage one. Many readers don't identify with demons like kleptomania or cocaine, but everyone fights something. Many seemingly successful people, at stage three and beyond, visit stage one from time to time. Doctors self-medicate. Professors claim their research assistants work as their own. Morally upright employees steal computer equipment when the company doesn't pay bonuses. No matter how educated, intelligent, or together people may seem, each of us is capable of descending into this stage. In the moment we do, life sucks, and anything is permissible. Helping those at stage one starts with seeing that we're all capable of it. If the demon is let out of the cage for long, people at stage one go into the middle of the stage, often alienated from their tribe and alone. For many, the secret remains tucked away. They drink themselves into oblivion every night and wake up sober and go to work. Others enlist support for their addiction and create codependent relationships. When their tribe has had enough, they perform an intervention and people are forced to make a choice: give up the addiction and move up to stage two, or remain addicted and find themselves alone in the middle of stage one. Moving others up. As we'll hear again and again in this book, the essence of advancing stages is giving up the language and behavior of one zone and adopting the practices of the next. People can skip sub-stages, but they cannot skip whole stages. That is, a person cannot go from 1 to 3, like passing go in Monopoly. They have to visit stage 2 first. Sometimes this process means switching tribes. There are two ways to move from stage 1 to stage 2. First, the person has to substitute "life sucks" with "my life sucks," the mantra of stage two. The difference in these stages is huge, and moving forward means dropping language that the nature of life is flawed, and saying instead that life works for some people but not for you. When we interviewed Joseph, he talked as someone who had made the transition. I had to give up my art, because the cost is my family. He sounded like a victim of circumstance. That others can do art, but not him. His life sucked. He's made it to stage two. Second, the person can move to a tribe where the offending behavior is not tolerated. The mother of a former gang member whose son began attending a church-run youth center told us, "I'm worried. He used to be so alive, but now it's like the cord got pulled." From a tribal perspective, her son went from the fire of despairing hostility, stage one, to the passivity of being an apathetic victim, stage two. This was progress. When we interviewed him, he looked sad and said, "This place sucks. I don't know anyone here." He had gone from the alienation of stage one to the disconnection of stage two. If people in his situation follow the advice in later chapters, they will continue their forward progress into stage three and beyond. We conclude with the principle that runs throughout this book. Give everyone a choice, and then work with the living. Don't try to raise the dead. There are people in all three parts of stage one who want life to be different, and our advice to employers is to give them a chance. William, part of Joseph's tribe, has made doing so a part of his design and general contracting business. Design for You in Chicago. He employs former gang members, convicts, and people who have fallen into and out of heavy drug use. He believes that helping people out of stage one is the responsibility of every person in society. At the same time, if people aren't willing to leave the allure of stage one, he doesn't pursue them. If they relapse into despairing hostility, he invokes the horse whisperer protocol and pushes them out, but watches for when they're ready to try again. In the next chapter, we look at what happens when he's successful and people move to stage two. Summary of stage one. The person at stage one is alienated from others, expressing the view that life sucks. When people at this stage cluster together, their behavior expresses despairing hostility, such as formation of a gang. Leverage points for a person at stage one. If the person is willing to move forward, encourage him to go where the action is. This means having lunch with coworkers, attending social functions, and going to meetings. Further encourage him to notice ways in which life itself works. For example, a person can notice that your life is pretty good, so it's possible that his may improve. Encourage him to cut ties with people who share the life sucks language. Success indicators. He will use my life sucks language as opposed to life sucks. In other words, his concern has shifted from a generalized gripe to a specific set of reasons why his life doesn't function as it should. In particular, he will compare himself to others' abilities, social advantages, and most of all, interpersonal connections. He will exhibit the passive apathy of stage two, as opposed to the despairing hostility of stage one. This shift may appear as a setback to people who aren't familiar with tribal leadership. In fact, it is a major step forward. He will cut his social ties to people who are in stage one. Chapter 5. Stage 2. Disconnected and disengaged. The essence of stage two is my life sucks, and it accounts for 25% of workplace cultures. People at this stage feel they are victims of circumstance and that there's no way to get traction for their ideas or ambition. When they are presented with new visions, their reaction is, "We tried that before and it didn't work then and won't work now." They tend to be passive, doing the minimum amount of work necessary to get by. It's easy to spot stage two from the outside. To see it, we only have to look at the organizations most people love to hate. The Department of Motor Vehicles, doctor's offices that make us wait 45 minutes reading magazines older than we are, while the receptionist moves so slowly we wonder if she may have died. Travelers all scratch their heads as security screeners sit around talking while the line stretches out the terminal door. The workers apparently oblivious that people are about to miss their flights. From an outsider's perspective, the two questions people ask, often with anger in their voice, are these: why doesn't anyone do something about this situation? And how can people be so stupid? As one person asked Dave on a recent plane flight, as the flight attendants forgot to offer beverages, "How can they be that stupid and still live? I mean, their brain at least remembers to make their heartbeat, right?" Doing something about stage two is difficult. Most managers are trained to utilize techniques that not only don't advance people but hold them at this zone of apathy. As a result, stage two is the second most common we find in organizations, after stage three. We've seen stage two in the highest levels of government in Washington, D.C., among bank executives in Asia, on boards of directors of Fortune 500 companies, in Italian cathedrals, and in the halls of companies praised as America's best places to work. Overall, about 25% of workplace tribes are dominant stage two, and the percentage goes up when organizations hit major obstacles, like a recession, falling reimbursement rates in healthcare, tight competition among the airlines, or increasing competition for manufacturers based in the United States. We see stage two mostly when people believe they cannot act creatively, where jobs are so mechanized that they feel like part of a machine. We've seen vibrant organizations, stage four and five, devolve into canyons of bureaucracy. As a result, tribes drop from stage four to three to two. As we heard with stage one, the insider's view as a member of stage two is different. It holds together, is consistent. It deflects advice from any other stage. Our goal in this chapter is to see how it works, what holds people in its grasp, and how to get ourselves and others to advance, so that tribes can leave stage two behind. Stage two, a view from the inside. Stage two and stage three need each other. Roger's story shows the dynamic. It was early Friday when Roger boarded a plane from Chicago to the West Coast, where he worked as a manager for a major high technology company. He was tired from running focus groups the night before, gauging the likely reaction to his company's upcoming product launch. When he landed and got to his car, he checked his voicemail. Five messages. Odd for a Friday morning, he thought. The first was from one of the company's attorneys, who said that there was a potential lawsuit alleging that one of Roger's products violated a copyright of a competitor. The second and third messages were panicked calls from one of Roger's team members, ending with, "This is getting big fast. Get here now." The fourth message was from the attorney again, this time on a speakerphone. The general counsel of the company is waiting to see you, he said. His tone was different. Like we had never met before, Roger told us months later. He added, it was clear to me that the general counsel, known as the Tiger in the office, was standing over his shoulder. This is someone I had never seen in the office, and the lore was that if the Tiger ever wants to see you, it's really, really bad for you. The last message was from Roger's boss, Todd. Only the names have been changed. Every other detail is exactly as it happened. Yelling. The Tiger wants to see you. What's going on here, and where are you? As with the attorney, Todd's tone was as though they never met. Finally, Todd arrived. Roger tells us the story. I show up at the office, and I'm tired, dirty from travel. I round the corner, and I see Todd's assistant waiting outside my office. Wait out in the hall. I need to go get Todd, she says. I had just enough time to peek in my office, and everything I had was in boxes. Even the pictures were off the walls and wrapped up. I said, oh my God. Todd marches in and says, they're waiting for you downstairs in legal. I asked if I could put my stuff down and he said, no, let's go now. I pointed my office and said, really? I couldn't believe it. Todd, 3 years and it comes down to this. Really? By now a crowd is gathering. Members of my team look scared. Todd has already turned and is 10 steps ahead of me walking down the hall. Are you sure? I couldn't believe it. His assistant grabs my arm and escorts me behind Todd. It was like security leading me from my office. We get about 15 steps and Todd turns to me and says, ah, gotcha. He high-fives his assistant, who looks apologetic, and then shouts, that was money. People in Roger's team were looking away. So the whole thing was a joke? Roger asked. Todd answered, that you're being fired? Yes. Well, at least for now, but legal really does want to see you, and this copyright issue is getting ugly fast. Come on, they're waiting for us. Todd led Roger to the Tiger's office. After a 2-hour meeting, which Roger describes as an interrogation, he unpacked his office and went home, took a nap, and spent the afternoon working out his rage on the tennis court. The effect of bosses like Roger's are devastating to a culture. Their actions have the same effect as an earthquake or a bomb going off. People scatter. They dive under their desks. Some leave the building and don't come back. After the emergency is over, they check on one another, treat the wounded, mourn the dead, and go on, living with the knowledge that it will happen again. Not surprisingly, a lot of energy is spent in quiet protest of the boss and the company that permits, even seems to encourage from the perspective of the employees, random acts of ruthlessness. The culture that forms as a result is the essence of stage 2. People's words express that they are victims, powerless. Their life sucks, they say. Not life itself, which is stage 1, but their life. They can see the boss's life is good. They describe their bosses as Teflon characters for whom no misdeed is punished. Roger's VP in the story drove a Porsche, made a lot of money, was respected in his industry, and often took calls from headhunters. Someone who works for a boss like Todd, who is typical of stage 3, I'm great and you're not, has a choice. Fight the boss or give in. The person who fights it moves to stage 3, and the battle for supremacy begins, like dogs fighting for alpha status. For Roger, this move would have cost him what he wanted most. His first big promotion after getting his MBA from Kellogg at Northwestern. If he left before getting the brand manager title, he would lose career momentum. The choice Roger made, as he told us, was to suck it up. Although still intelligent and ambitious, he temporarily became a lapdog, his words, to get what he wanted. In the meantime, he disconnected from his passion and put up with the nonsense. Many people in Roger's situation do put up with it until they're promoted, and then they find themselves the victim of another set of circumstances, the next boss. This pattern can continue for an entire career, and we've seen some CEOs, happily not most, firmly planted at stage two, complaining that they couldn't implement the right directives because the board of directors wouldn't let them. As long as people are in stage two, they believe their destiny is not their own. As a result, they avoid accountability. People tend to use phrases like, "I'll try," "I can't promise," "I'm not sure what my boss will say about that." "That's not possible. We can't do that." "It's against policy," and "I can't make someone else do their job." Physicists define power as the time rate of work. In that sense, the stage two language screen nets out to, "My words are not powerful, because even though I gripe all day, nothing changes." Sometimes, the cause of stage two is not a person, but a system. We worked with one company that had a stage five culture in its early days. As the company hired more people, many were bureaucrats who implemented best practice systems. 10 years later, one person told us, "It used to be about the mission. Now it's about the paperwork." She went on to say, "I'm paid too well, mostly in options, to leave, so I just put up with it." In this way, her life sucks, and the dominant tribal stage in this company is a two. Even golden handcuffs can become a trap to keep people in stage two. The language system of stage two also deflects core values. When we ask people at this stage what principles guide their lives, we heard a sort of pseudo-wisdom. In the words of one manager at a public utility, "I thought values were important once too, but I came to see that sort of talk just disappoints you in the end." Stage two has an ineffective relationship with values that comes across as cynicism, sarcasm, or resignation. Most, like Roger, eventually advance to stage three, where they become the same sort of manager they hated. As we'll hear in the next two chapters, they don't need to stay at this stage for long. In the meantime, they tend to join forces with others who feel disconnected, and a stage two culture forms. If it's early stage two, the group is in danger of lapsing into hostile behavior, one of the hallmarks of stage one. Most stage two cultures are in the middle, and they represent what our colleague Scott Weiner, a CFO in healthcare, calls the entrenched mediocrity. Late stage two is where Roger went, a group of people all vying for promotion, putting up with the nonsense until they can get themselves out. Early stage two. People in early stage two are on the edge between stage one and two, so they are always in danger of regressing. We consulted to a large manufacturing company that was in the process of offshoring its operations to Asia, and during the waves of layoffs, the tribe descended to early stage two. Although the end of the U.S. plant came without incident, the managers organized a betting pool about which division would be the first to have an employee show up and go postal. When people advance from stage one, they usually end up in early stage two. Joseph from the last chapter is in early stage two. In this zone, he's always in danger of relapsing into "life sucks" language, and the accompanying behavior of despairing hostility linked with out-of-control drug use. As long as he stays sober, though, He believes that he's gotten the short end of life's stick, but that life can work out for some people. People in early stage two are often on probation in their tribes, either for past lapses or for what people perceive as likely future behavior. Coaching tip. Have zero tolerance for stage one behavior. The key to stabilizing people at stage two is to stay in the midst of others who don't tolerate stage one behavior. If they withdraw, people should go after them, attempting to bring them back into the tribe. If it becomes clear they have decided to lapse and won't listen to anyone, the tribe should give them clear rules about how to come back, such as Joseph's 30-day penalty for drug use. When people cluster into stage two, their discussions often focus on how they're being screwed by management or the system. Unlike the people we met in the previous chapter, their beef is with their life and with the people they see are to blame for their lot, not with life in general. They can see that their lives could work out, while stage one sees only continued despair. People at early stage two concern those at later stages, since early stage two is unstable. It's at risk for descending into the abyss of stage one. Managers, like those in the manufacturing company, fear, and rightly so, workplace violence or self-destructive behavior, including suicide. We noted several suicides in dot-com companies that went out of business in the crash. People had descended from stage five. We can do anything. We're reinventing retailing, to four. We're greater than our rival because we have more cash than they do, to three. You're losing your job. That's too bad. I still have mine. To two. I'm out of work. There are no prospects and my Porsche just got repossessed. To one. Drugs and suicide. This is the fear people have of early stage two behavior, that the person will go all the way to stage one, especially if the person has fallen quickly from the later stages. It seems like he's melting down. When will he hit bottom? Is how one manager expressed fear about an ex-employee to us. People in early stage two take one of three paths. One, they find a tribe that is mostly early stage two and they stay there. Two, they leave behind the edge of their anger and move upward. Or, three, they descend to stage one, like Joseph. Middle stage two. People at the middle of stage two tend to cluster together in tight bands that, from the outside, resemble stage four. We're great. Unlike these later stage tribes, however, middle stage twos are united in their belief that someone or something is holding them down, standing in their way. It might be the boss, the system, their lack of education, or their belief that mom or dad didn't raise them to be competitive. The key is that they accept this obstacle as the way it is and the way it always will be. They give up, and they band together in a sort of support group for the oppressed. The most usual suspect is the boss. And one of the hallmarks of middle stage two is Dilbert cartoons on cubicle walls, taped on the coffee machine, even hanging from the leaves of plastic office plants. In a sense, Dilbert creator Scott Adams has become the spokesperson for people whose lives suck because, in their view, they work for an ass. Dilbert, a cartoonish parody, is uncomfortably accurate for what 25% of professionals in the United States experience in their everyday workplace. Making fun of bad managers, idiot bosses, in Dilbertese, is Adams's stock and trade. And, from our research, constitutes a lot of how people in middle stage 2 spend their time, because stage 2 discussions often resolve down to, "My boss is making my life suck." We couldn't think of anyone better than Adams to help explain the mindset from the inside. We interviewed Adams about why so many people are unhappy at work and feel they can't do anything about it. "Idiot bosses are built into the system," he said. "If you hire somebody who truly cared about the employees, they would be completely ineffective as a leader. You'd be saying stuff like, 'Well, we couldn't get the profits because we didn't want to miss our kids' Little League games. Why don't we push the deadline out a little bit?' As soon as the employees smelled weakness, everybody would have a dead relative they'd have to go to the funeral for. There's a level of toughness and coldness and evil that is required. The system breaks down if you don't have that." The word "evil" is carefully chosen. As Adams pointed out when we asked what kind of boss Dilbert would be, "He'd be a poor boss because I've often said that leadership requires a deep and innate sense of evil. If you think about it, the whole point of leadership is to get people to do things they don't want to do on their own. So, for example, you don't need a leader to say, 'Eat this bowl of delicious cookies.'" Adams continues, "But what about, 'I'd like you to work on the weekend instead of seeing your family because I'll get a big bonus when you're done?' It's just pure evil. You're trying to get people to do things that aren't in their best interest, and they know on some level it's not in their best interest, but using your leaderly skills and your Rasputin-like ability to get people to do what you want, they do it anyway. The essence of leadership is getting people to do things that they know isn't in their self-interest." Adams has created a perfect parody of Stage 3, and he's made it seem obvious why Stage 2 cultures form as a reaction to "I'm great and you're not," the mantra of Stage 3 bosses. He also helps answer a question that people at later stages often ask about those who work for Stage 3 bosses. "If your boss is such an idiot, why don't you go somewhere else?" He answered the question this way: "I worked at Crocker Bank in San Francisco, and I thought that things happening at that big company couldn't be happening in other big companies. It must be something deeply defective about the one place I chose to work. Then I changed jobs, and the acronyms changed, and the buildings changed, but all the stuff that bothered me was eerily similar." "A lot of people wrote to me when Dilbert first started," he added, "saying that I had cut down on their desire to change jobs because they could see it must be the same everywhere." Adams contends that this growing awareness that evil bosses are everywhere led to an acceptance that organizations are just ineffective and that evil bosses are part of corporate DNA. We should note that we don't use words like evil to describe any aspects of any stage. In fairness, we believe Adams was using this word for dramatic effect. The problem with words like bad, evil, and wrong is that when they are used as labels, the person can't escape from them. The Trap of Middle Stage 2. While Stage 2 often forms in response to evil bosses, it forms for lots of other reasons as well. In our research, people blamed lack of education, poor social networks, lack of political skill, an inability to think strategically, or an unsupportive spouse who wouldn't let them work the extra hours required for success. At this point, Guru Adams and tribal leadership part ways, although we hope on friendly terms. We tried to get Adams's assurance that we wouldn't become the newest villains in Dilbert, but he merely emailed back a smiley face. For many people in middle stage 2, their residence at "My Life Sucks" seems immune to getting rid of the subject of their complaints. If managers fix what they snarl about, they go out and get more reasons to be unhappy. people in our studies did complain about idiot bosses, but also about the name of the company. It took too long to type out on emails. The temperature at 72 degrees, just too hot. The printer took forever, actually 10 seconds, from the time they hit Control P until they had hard copy. Even though we just gathered data, we found that our own mood fell to "my life sucks" when we spent time hearing about why people's lives suck. We felt we were being pulled into stage two right along with the complainers. "My coworker has BO," we heard. "Then tell him to get right guard," we thought. "My boss is mean to my friend," people said, making us wonder, "and this is your problem because..." "The floor is too slippery," we heard. "That's why they call it wax," we thought. The more we heard gripes, the more our lives sucked for having heard them. The truth is that no one is immune to the siren song of stage two, not even people collecting data on it. What's going on here? We wondered. Not only do some people appear complaint-addicted, but also they seem miserable about it. As we fell down the stage two well, one manager asked what he could do, and we suggested putting Prozac in the water cooler. We later apologized, even though the manager thought it was funny. The fact is that stage two wants to avoid accountability at all costs and will invent reasons to remain disconnected and disengaged. In our public seminars, we've developed a method to show people how quickly stage two can form. "I'll tell you why my life sucks, and then you have to do the same," we'll say, often to groups of 100 or more. We start, "My life sucks because I have to be here with all of you." At first, stunned silence fills the room. People look around, reach for their water glasses, or try to look distracted by noticing the design of the carpet. That same flower design that haunts the dreams of people on the speaking circuit. "My life sucks because I have to listen to you," someone will say. Nervous giggles bubble up, followed by the awkward silence. "Who said that?" we'll ask. No one volunteers, except on occasion, people around him pointing the finger in the guilty person's direction. We'll then ask, "Whose life sucks more than his?" "My life sucks because I drove 3 hours to get here, and I have to listen to this drivel," someone will say, usually laughing. Laughter floats up again, this time lasting longer. "My life sucks because my mom lives with us. My life sucks because my boss is here, so I can't say how much he sucks. My life sucks because I have 3 kids in private school. My life sucks because my company just changed its health plan again." The comments come faster and faster. The laughter gets louder and louder. Finally, the whole room gets going. Depending on the type of group, doctors are polite, salespeople aren't, the room will become so boisterous that we have to unclip our lapel mics, move them an inch from our faces, and yell, "Okay, come back." Before order resumes, the bitching continues. "My life sucks because I have to do 80 hours a year of training. My life sucks because I have 200 unread emails." Almost every time, as if scripted, someone will end the gripe fest by saying, "My life sucks because this discussion is what my job is like every day." We've never found a workshop where stage two fails to form, and we've tried it with some unlikely people. Church leaders, where we substitute the word stinks for sucks, state senators, judges, deans of college schools, accountants, executive coaches, and lots of doctors. Coaching tip: upgrade the culture, don't attack the conspiracy theories. At early and middle stage two, conspiracy theories tend to form. They result from our desire for cognitive consistency, that everything needs to make sense, and the psychological drive to have some control, As people at Stage 2 told us, if I see it coming, I can prepare. As a result, conspiracies are welcomed into Stage 2 cultures. Conspiracy theories we heard included these. They're going to close our operation. The company is about to be sold. And they're going to cut our pay by 10%. Managers often try to attack these conspiracies by denying them, putting their personal credibility on the line. This approach almost never works, as people remember Ken Lay, former Enron CEO, giving his assurance that his company would recover. We often remind people that Stage 2 thinks of the boss as evil, in Scott Adams's language. So personal credibility is meaningless. In fact, denial of the conspiracy becomes proof of the vastness of the cover-up. A better approach is to work on upgrading the culture, which we discuss at the end of the chapter. As the culture moves from 2 to 3, the conspiracies disappear on their own. That's the point. No matter how educated, successful, talented, ambitious, or enlightened you are, we are. Stage 2 is like a trap waiting to snap shut. It starts with one gripe, then another. Soon everyone says only negative comments. The cycle amplifies as the entire group joins in. In our sessions, people's laughter is a positive reinforcement that keeps it running. In work tribes, the discussion is often somber, the mood like a movie when the hero has discovered a conspiracy so vast it is unstoppable. We heard comments like, "They're reducing our benefits," and "They're cutting the subsidies at the cafeteria." Those were followed with, "It won't be long until they start to move our jobs to India," and "I heard the board decided to close us down." We hold up the hope that the Dalai Lama or the Pope may be so enlightened that they wouldn't play along. Deep down, though, we think they'd fall in line too, or at least tacitly encourage their followers to play. As people who use language, Stage 2 is lurking in the shadows for all of us. Coaching tip: tell people they're valued. The language system of Stage 2 nets out to, "I'm not valued." As a result, people feel disconnected and disengaged, and their culture acts as a support group for others who are disengaged as well. Managers can start to break up this culture by taking a personal interest in the lives of their employees, in a way that doesn't seem to be part of a formula. Remembering everyone's birthday, for example, is interpreted by Stage 2 as nothing more than a computerized scheduling system and an administrative assistant ordered to buy a cake. Bosses who know the names and ages of employees' children, their hobbies and interests, do better than those who offer programs, such as Employee of the Month. One of the best ways to attack the "I'm not valued" view is to say, "I value you. What can I do to encourage you to stay?" Beverly Kay and Sharon Jordan Evans offer great tips in their book, Love 'Em or Lose 'Em. Such tips work best when they are combined with the steps to advancing culture at the end of this chapter. Dominant Stage 2 cultures all seem to have wise people appointed by the culture, never by the management. One of our clients calls them keepers of the sacred flame of no accountability. In a large nonprofit organization where one of us worked, we overheard a seasoned employee giving advice to a young recruit. "Don't try too hard, it only raises expectations," the older man said. "The key word is pretend. Pretend you're overworked and no one will bother you. Pretend it's someone else's fault and you get to do what you want. Pretend you're waiting on another department, and you'll get praised at raise time." Middle Stage 2 soaks in this cycle of accountability avoidance and complaint generation. As a result, managers who attempt to earn trust by fixing what bothers people feel that their energy is being drained by a cultural vampire. The needs are endless, the complaints inexhaustible, and in the end, most managers give in to the inevitable and assume this is all people are capable of doing. Technical note. In our research, people are accurate in identifying the cultural stage of others. In fact, they are almost as accurate as trained observers using surveys, focused interview questions, and sociograms, methods of graphing relationships. There is one exception. People give themselves a two-stage bonus. People at stage one think they're at three. People at two think they're at four. How can you tell if you're in stage two or four? Look for power. Do your words create change in the organization? Are your relationships connected by core values? What bonds you to your tribe? A common enemy or a common view that we can't win? Late stage two. At the time of Roger's story, he wasn't a member of middle stage two. He didn't hang Dilbert cartoons on the wall, and he wasn't part of the entrenched mediocrity. He represented a band of employees who were putting in their time, waiting for the promotion out of what one person in our study called the ghetto of corporate despair. This last part of stage two doesn't want to continue in my life sucks, but rather get to I'm great, stage three. They often feel their careers are temporarily set back because of idiot bosses, like Todd, but with one more promotion, some political maneuvering, or one vocal executive, they will succeed. What holds them in stage two is the belief that I'll be great soon. Ironically, if the person were just to shift soon to now, he would be in stage three, since language creates the stage. While our studies focused on language use and the structure of relationships rather than age or education level, we noticed late stage two mostly among people who expressed the view that their careers were in their early stages. We also noticed late stage two among people who had achieved success, but were knocked back by a temporary